Today's Keisho will be on Case 81 in the Book of Serenity. Zhuang Sha comes to the district. Introduction. Move and shadows appear. Notice and dust arises. Lifting up, distinctly clear. Casting down, calm and peaceful. In a meeting of people of the way, how do they talk? When Zhuang Sha came to Pujian district, they welcomed him with 100 festivities. The next day, he asked Great Elder Zhao Tong, "Where has all of yesterday's commotion gone?" Zhao Tong held up the corner of his vestment. Zhuang Sha said, "There's no connection, not by a long shot." Hiding the boat in the night valley, setting the oar on the clear source, the dragon and fish don't know the water is their life. Busting a gut, nevertheless, it's just a little shake. Master Zhuang Sha, Elder Zhao Tong, are like box and lid, arrow points, probing pole, shadowing grass. Submerged, withdrawn, the old turtle nests among the lotuses, frolicking, and multicolored fish play in the water grasses. To thank everybody for doing such a magnificent job. This morning, once again, people were just sitting beautifully. This room was so still. People were so good. You know, I mean, I'm just so impressed how wholeheartedly everybody is practicing. It's really wonderful. This is day three of the Sesshin, for those of you who arrived on Tuesday night. So you may be rather tired today, probably, and you may feel that you're sort of like on your last legs. Yeah? And that is a condition that most of us don't want to be in, you know. I will meet some people at the sit on, say, Monday night or Friday night, and I'll come up to see them, and I'll say, "How was your sit?" And they'll say, "Oh, not that good. I just didn't get that much sleep yesterday." And I know that, you know, basically that's the answer that somebody would give if he or she had never been to Sesshin, right? Because we think that in order to do anything well, we need to have the proper condition. So we need to have 8 hours of sleep, or if our habit is 7 hours of sleep, 7 hours of sleep. Preferably a good meal, right? And to sit on the cushion at some point in the day and to have a beautiful sit. Be nice. You know? So, good day, not too much stress, no traffic, get to the Lucy Stone Hall, sit down, everybody's ready to sit, so there's no commotion, no problems, you know, have a nice sit, beautiful. Now, the truth is that if that happens, it's wonderful, right? It's wonderful. But, actually, if that is all there is to Zen, we should all pack up our bags and go home right now. So I'm glad to see nobody's getting up. But now for a lot of people, that's what they think this is about, or that's what they're looking for, right? They're looking for, when you say, "I'm going to a retreat," they think, "Oh, how wonderful, you know, a retreat. I'm going to the, I'm going to spend a 5-day retreat, meditation. And they do think, probably, you know, we're going to get up and eat granola for breakfast, you know, and you know, sit in a circle and talk and have little timeouts where we can go back to our room and keep, you know, it's in the journal, you know, my meditation journal, you know. And you know, at night we can share, you know, we can all share how it went today, you know. And you know, that's great. If that's your path, that's wonderful. But you know, then you get in your car and you drive home and, you know, what do you know? It doesn't usually happen, but in New Jersey, but on that particular day, the traffic has piled up, right? It's bumper to bumper on the Garden State Parkway all the way to the Route 18 turnoff, you know. And then somebody cuts you off in traffic and you almost have an accident, and you get home and there's a, you know, they shut off your electricity or something, you know, and there's a phone message from your boss and he says, "Where were you? You know, I thought you were coming in on Thursday," you know. And it's like, you know, what happened to your beautiful stillness, your beautiful, you know, and you put the meditation journal on the chair and there it sits, right? And so if that would be, if that's all there is to Zen practice, this would be, I think, rather hollow. You know, we have a deeper practice in that. When you're in day 3 of a sesshin, you often find that you're at a kind of, maybe this isn't how it is for you, but for a long time for me, a day 2 evening or day 3 was like a point at which I just was at my last ebb of strength. You know, I just felt kind of like a shot. I didn't have the willpower to do anything, and usually the pain in my legs was very significant, and I was just, you know, at my last gasp. And the strange thing is that you know, what often will happen to you during sesshin, and if it doesn't happen at this sesshin, it will happen, is that you suddenly get like this infusion of energy, this infusion of energy. It's like the dead coming back to life, really. And anybody who's done this long enough has had this experience where, you know, day 1 you think, you know, and if you've done sesshin for a long time, you go through a process too. Day 1 you think, well, this is not so bad. Maybe, you know, it's going to be easier than in the past. Right? Then day 2 comes and you think, well, this is not so easy, right? And often on the morning of day 3, it's like, you know, you might have thought on day 1, maybe I'll sit through the second sit and not move, right? And day 3, at the end of the first sit, you're thinking, ring the bell, please, you know. And then when that bell rings, it's like, oh, thank God, you know, and you uncross your poor, tired legs, right? But sometime, what will happen to you is that around this time, or a little earlier or a little later, you'll get like a second wind. It's like there's a kind of energy arises spontaneously. And it may even happen to you, it might not this time, but it may eventually happen to you that on the last day of sesshin, you can't even, you have a hard time sleeping. You know, sometimes this doesn't happen right away. It might not happen at this sesshin. I can remember many sesshins where I went to bed, literally my legs were hurting me so much, my teeth were chattering. Really. I mean, I can remember in our group, before we had our own place, we did a sesshin out at a state park called Moses Lake. It's in eastern Washington. That was beautiful. There were coyotes howling at night, and it was a a camp facility with the cabins and a big building that we made into our Zen hall. And I remember going out at night, and the big moon was in the sky, and it was a desert area. You know, there were all these big boulders all around the area. And I remember I was on the macadam path walking back to my room, and literally I was just my teeth were chattering because I was in so much pain. And in those days I used to just hit the mat, you know, it's just that hit the mattress, you know. I would look at that mattress, I would think, I should wash my face and brush my teeth. Nah, boom. You know? The next thing I know, it's a clap, 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 time to get up. Right? So it might not happen this time. But what will eventually happen to you is that you really will begin to have this energy, this extraordinary energy. And if you just hang in there, this is going to happen to you. It's just wonderful. And it happens sometimes in individual sits too, right? I mean, you come into the Zendo, you sit down on the cushion, and at first especially, it's very difficult to know how to position your body on the cushion. So it's a little bit hit or miss, right? You know the cushion the cushion, it looks like it's on the mat properly. You sit down, and then you suddenly notice, I'm not aligned properly. You know, maybe one hip is a little higher than another, or maybe the cushion's a little bit too far forward, and you can tell maybe after about 5 or 10 minutes that your posture isn't quite right, right? And then you're stuck there for 25 or 30 minutes. So as you get a little more experienced, you become more skillful. You remember how to sit on the cushion. This leg has to hang off a little more than this leg, you know. And you get very intelligent about this. But unfortunately, no matter how intelligent you get, your legs are eventually going to bother you, yeah? And so there's a little process people go through, you know, where you become a little bit more intelligent about how to sit on the cushion, and you have like your strategies, you know. So left leg is lower than the right, cushion, extra pillow goes under right knee, you know, so on. And but by like day three, you know, really, you have pain. It's there, and there's nothing you can do. Those strategies are exhausted, right? And then you have to work with your mind. And so you might actually, start squeezing with your hara. You squeeze with the hara. You call. You watch the breath go out, 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 or you call mu. And you do begin to have these moments where you encounter this stillness at the end of your breath, this motionless state. It's like stillness is the best way to describe it. It's like absolute stillness. Right? And it doesn't always happen because the mind gets tired. And it's sometimes hard to find that place. But if you keep practicing, you will get to a point where it's really quite easy to get to that place. It really is quite easy. That in Zen, that place where you're very still, and your body might feel empty, or your hands or face disappear, or it has many different forms. It could feel like pulsing electricity. Different people experience it differently. Some people feel like they're made of eggshell or spider web, you know. It's like there's just like residual awareness of parts of your body, and the hearing faculty is still there. And that state's called samadhi, and the more you get there, the easier it is to get there in the future. You can't be told how to do it. I mean, the teacher can say, sit on the cushion, straighten your back, breathe with your hara, watch the breath, but, you know, you have to find that place yourself, you know. And when you find it, it gets easier and easier to get back there. It will. You know, after you find it, it doesn't mean the next time you sit you're going to get back there. That's very unlikely. You know? But you will get back there more and more, and if you keep practicing, eventually you'll get there very easily. My first teacher, Genki Roshi, was really quite well known in Japan and in the United States for being a very, very excellent meditation teacher, meditation practitioner. He was a student of a person named Yamamoto Genpo Roshi of Ryutakuji. And he was, you know, Genki was thought to be quite a superb meditator. And when I began to enter samadhi, I asked Genki Roshi, how long does it take you to enter samadhi? Because I got to the point where I could enter that state actually after about 8 or 9 years of practice, within about 20 minutes. You know, at first, you might hit it once during a session or twice during a session. Eventually, you get there more often, and after 6, 7, 8 years, you can get there pretty regularly, almost all the time, or all the time. But it took me, after I think about 8 years of practice, it took me about 20 minutes. And I asked Genki Roshi, how long does it take you to get there? And by the way, he was the most unpretentious person in the world. Just amazingly unpretentious. More on this in just a minute. But he said, it takes a couple of seconds. And he had been practicing for 40 years, right? You know, so since he was like 12, really, you know, or something, or 15. So he said, oh, it takes me just a couple seconds. And I said, well, what, you know, oh my God. You know, what happens? And he said, well, I sit on the cushion, you know, I straighten my back, I breathe through my hara. And he said, and then I feel like I'm a stick of incense. And the stick is burning down very fast, and the top of my head disappears, and then the rest of my body disappears, and then it's gone. And then I'm in samadhi. And that was wonderful. When I heard that, I was very inspired, and I also knew I had a long way to go, you know. But he really could enter that state very quickly, and he told me other things too that were true and amazing, you know. If you're working on koans, as everybody here is, you know, it might take you a while to. It might take you a while to get through your first koan. Pass is not quite the right word, but or answer is a an even worse word than pass. But when you're working with a koan, basically you're being asked to explore some aspect of the moment, of reality. And you can explore it more or less deeply, but you might miss it altogether. And usually people get a little bit stuck. When you're trying to answer your koan, often your assumptions get in the way. So, I've talked about this before, but for the benefit of people who are new, you know, it's actually very difficult for some people to just be in the moment, even for a few seconds, even with something as simple as the breath. You know, people will come in Dokusan, and sometimes they'll say, you know, they're new. They'll come to a session, they're a new person, and I'll say, what's happening with your breath? And they'll say, well, you know, it's basically just going out my nose. I'm like, I have nothing to report. Yeah. And when I hear that, I'm thrilled, because that's really remarkable. I wasn't like that at all. You know, when I first started doing Zen practice, I would come in to see Genki Roshi, and he would say, tell me about your breath, you know. Or he used to put it more poetically. He would say, tell me about the breath with eyes, which is actually a beautiful description. he'd say, tell me about the breath with eyes. And I would think, you know, I knew I was working on the breath koan, so I'd say, oh, all is one. You know, it's all one. You know, and, you know, ding, in traditional Zen practice, you don't just leave, the teacher rings a little bell, which means that's enough for today. So I get the bell, you know. Because it was so hard for me to not try to be a philosopher about things, and not try to, now there's nothing wrong with philosophy, but Zen is more like science than philosophy. It's more empirical, see. The significance of things or the implications are not that important. Because if you think about it, no two philosophers agree about anything. It's really true. You know, and philosophers are just talking about the ordinary world of consciousness that we all experience every day. And they still don't agree. Right? So basically, interpretation is an iffy proposition. Right? You might interpret it this way, but Zen is not really interested in interpretation. It's interested in reporting on what's actually happening. So it's very difficult for people to report on what's actually happening. So it took me a long time. And in fact, it took me 5 years to answer the breath perception koan. I was working with the breath. When Genki Roshi arrived from Japan, it was 1977. And all these people, at that time, Zen was really, on the West Coast, Buddhism was really just coming to consciousness. And all of these like hippie types, you know, we heard this, a Zen master's come to from Japan. It was, wow, you know, let's go see this cat, you know? And, you know, it's great. There were probably 50 people at the first sit. You know, it was people had, you know, expectations about what Zen was like. But you know, I think we probably got about 50 people for the first session, and some of them, you know, didn't stick with it. Zen didn't quite measure up to their expectations. But some of them stayed for forever, really, you know, still practicing. And I was part of that, like, class of 1977. Mm-hmm. And everybody started doing Zen practice. We all got Susoku Kan. And I got Susoku Kan. And you're not supposed to discuss Dokusan, you know, people would let me know. I passed another koan. It's like, another one? Wow, great. How about you? So it began to dawn on me that everybody else was passing their koans, right? And I'm stuck in the basement. I'm stuck in kindergarten, right? With the breath perception. Or that's what I thought. Breath perception is a wonderful foundation for practice. It's if you don't have a good foundation with breath perception meditation, nothing can be accomplished. So Genki Roshi did me a big favor. But I was such a philosopher, I was not able to be in the simplicity of the moment very easily. So the point is, you know, you want to just be present in the moment and report on that, and that's all you have to do. Anyway, I wanted to tell you something about Genki Roshi and how much I love my teachers, both of them, Genki Roshi and Webb Roshi. I just wanted to say that Genki Roshi, I mentioned earlier, was like this totally unpretentious person. He used to say all the time, if I can wake up, anybody can wake up. And it wasn't false modesty. He was like he was just such an unassuming, unpretentious person. And he was a generous and friendly and a warm person. This morning I was actually thinking about him as I was coming in to sit, and I was thinking about the fact that he loved noodles, you know. In many ways, the story of Zen in Japan is the story of monks and their noodles, you know, because they all eat noodles and they all love them. And by the way, I've been reading this wonderful book that I love. It's called The Bones of the Master, and it's about a Chinese monk. And what do you know? Noodles, right? But Genki Roshi loved udon, you know? And when I think of Genki Roshi sometimes, I just see him in the kitchen making a gigantic plate of for all of us, a gigantic pot of udon, you know? And any opportunity is to make noodles, and he just looks so happy, you know? Now, the truth is, eating noodles all the time is not good for you. And my beloved teacher developed diabetes. And his doctor said, you have to give up noodles. And now, it's not true anymore, but my teacher founded a Zen group in Montana recently, in the last, say, 10 years. And one of the things he talks about is brown rice. Yeah? So now it's the story of a monk and his brown rice. That kind of simplicity takes years to cultivate, right? Because we all want to be somewhere other than where we are right now. Just report on what's actually happening, and don't worry about success or failure at all. Let me get to the koan before we're out of time. When Xuanxia came to the Pujian district, they welcomed him with 100 festivities. The next day he asked Elder Zhao Tong, where has all of yesterday's commotion gone? Xuanxia is a famous Zen master who's come to the Pujian district in China. And when he arrived in these days, in the Tang Dynasty, coming of a Zen master was a very great event. Let me just stop here and digress again. I might never get through the koan, but you know, in the Tang Dynasty, people valued very highly the experience of enlightenment. And the whole culture, in some ways, supported enlightenment. This is true in Tibet also. But in China at this time, all over China, there were what were called public temples. And anybody who wanted to, man or woman, who wanted to dedicate himself or herself to enlighten, to waking up, could go to one of these temples and train. And it was basically free. So it's like we have public schools and public universities because our culture values learning. And in Tang Dynasty China, they had public temples because the whole culture thought that enlightenment was the highest thing. And so you could go anywhere in China and find a public temple that would accept you if you were a person of good character and you could train. And it was really quite a wonderful thing. And so people in Tang Dynasty China took Zen or took enlightenment really seriously. And in some ways, it was a much healthier society than our society, really and truly. Xuanxia has come to the Pujian district, and they welcomed him with 100 festivities. And it's like a big party, big blowout, right? The next day, he gets up, and he goes and he does his zazen, he goes outside, and he notices, boy, what happened to all the, where's the party? You know, it's like, next day, he asks great elder Zhao Tong, what has happened to all of yesterday's commotion? So let me stop there for just a minute. Because actually, This is sort of what is happening to all of us, isn't it? This is sort of what's happening to all of us. It's like, basically, we've all come here to practice Zen. And we come with all kinds of motives, curiosity. Some of us have had personal tragedies. Some of us have found in ourselves certain kinds of obstacles that we need to overcome. But whatever our motive, there's probably an element of that is a dissatisfaction, right? Dissatisfaction. Somebody came in this morning and was just talking about how beautiful the sit had gone, you know, and how the person said basically that last night during the sit, he felt this tremendous stillness, this tremendous peace and serenity. And it was beautiful, right? This beautiful sense of this. And a number of people have come in and said, you know, I don't know why my legs are hurting, my back is killing me, but I'm so happy. You know, I'm so happy. And I wish I could, you know, wish I could live my life like this, right? And this is an insight people sometimes have on day three of a sesshin, where you begin to get away from the craziness of our ordinary lives, the sort of craziness. And you begin to encounter this stillness that's so beautiful. This stillness is not really a quality of the environment totally. It's something we find in ourselves, right? It's like that motionless place inside yourself. But when you get in touch with that, everything takes on this character. It's this stillness, and it's like a lake with no waves on it. Yeah. So people have been coming in and talking about this, and a number of people have said, you know, boy, I realize just how crazy my life is back home. I realize how crazy it is, because you know we don't live in Tang Dynasty China. And the values of our society don't, you know, our society isn't based upon enlightenment, compassion, and so on. It's based on a whole different set of values. A lot of it has to do with competition, rivalry, aggression. And again, let me just get off the track for a minute and just mention that, we do Dokusan a little differently from other groups. If some of you have practiced at other places, you might be aware that we don't do Dokusan the way other people do. At other Zen centers, Dokusan works like this. The teacher leaves the room and goes into a place that's rather far from the sitting hall. And then there's a holding room where people wait to go to Dokusan. So basically, once the teacher leaves, people can get up and go into the holding room, and then everybody else stays where they are, see? So basically, if you're not going to go to Dokusan that day or at that time, you stay seated on the regular sitting schedule. And there's a person who has a clock and is ringing the bell and so on. And everybody else who goes to Dokusan goes into this holding room, and then they go one by one in to see the teacher. And the way it generally works in Japan, too, and in the United States, is that, when it's time to go to Dokusan, everybody runs for the Dokusan line, right? And it's basically like a teacher leaves, and people just, as he's going, it's like, on your mark, get set, go, you know, really. And everybody jumps up. You know, and run into the Dokusan room. And, you know, and in the places that I've trained, sometimes it's appalling. It's like, you know, people are elbowing each other, you know? And really, I'm not kidding, you know? It's like some people are trampled underfoot, and not really that place. But it just doesn't seem right to me, you know. That's like our society outside the temple, right? In my opinion, that's like a competitive. If I may say so, that's like competitive capitalism, isn't it? It's like everybody jostles and tries to get there first, right? And indeed, sometimes people who are older or slower have a very hard time ever getting to see the teacher, you know? A lot of places take names. In other words, if you didn't get the Dokusan during that period because you were at the back of the line, they'll put you at the front of the line later. They'll make sure they take your name and give you a chance at the next session. But all the same, very competitive. So this is like more of a socialist system here, right? Everybody goes to Dokusan, right? I think that's a better system. It's more consistent. Okay. The society is not particularly sane. And when we come to Sesshin, we have a lot of things to sort of work through in order to find this simplicity. How we live our lives is a huge influence on our mental state. So, you can't live in a society that's aggressive and competitive and not have that rub off on you a little bit. And you can't live in a society that's fearful and not have that become part of your personality. You can't live in a society that isn't in the moment and not have that affect you too. So, when we come to Sesshin, we have a few days where we just have to sort of get rid of all of this baggage. And so a lot of our struggles are not really with the body, even though it may seem that way. A lot of our struggles are with the mind. And it's like, it's just returning to this stillness takes some time and energy, yeah? And it's a lot of Zen practice is on learning. It's on learning. If I may say so, the world that Zen practice will open up to you will be quite unlike the world of ordinary consciousness. And people get little glimpses of this sometime. Maybe just like a flash, you know. But it happens little by little, and eventually your world is quite different, you know, in a lot of ways from ordinary reality, so-called. You just have to go through this process of simplifying and unlearning. And the obstacles involved in koan training often have to do with our assumptions, right? The values and beliefs we bring from that world out there. You know, so one problem for people doing koan training is that we have a whole set of assumptions about what is real and what's not. And let me give you a simple example. Some people are given the breath koan, and they just assume that I know what the breath is. This is for babies, right? You know, come on, give me a real koan, man. Really, I mean, I've encountered people who literally just every time they come in to see me, it's like, come on, let me go on to the real koans, you know? And nobody in this room, however, has said that, let me just say. But I have in the past encountered people who, it's just like, I don't want to do breath, I want to do something important. And in fact, that was my outlook. You know, when I had breath perception, I thought, come on, I want the mystical stuff, you know, I don't want this stuff. I know about my breath. But, when you begin to work with the breath, you begin to watch the breath does strange things. So for example, when you're breathing deeply, you might suddenly feel that the breath is coming out your eyes and not your nose, see? Or if you're calling moo, you might feel that you're calling moo with your ears, right? This is what's actually happening, see? But people think, well, I can't breathe through my forehead. There's no hole, right? You know? And so they don't mention that to me, you know. They think, I'm getting nowhere, you know. And I say, well, tell me about the breath. Well, nothing's happening. Well, tell me, you know. Well, when you breathe out, what happens? And they say, well, you know, sometimes it feels like it's coming out my forehead. Ah, wonderful. See? But they don't notice that this is important because they have all these assumptions. And with it more, you know, you keep working through koans, and this happens again and again, where people, their assumptions are preventing them from seeing something, that's right in front of them, but they can't glimpse it because they have a set of beliefs about what is real and what is not. And, you know, this is part of the unlearning process that it takes us a few days to go through, at least. And we have to do it over and over again. So, this is where we are, you know, the commotion, you know, we've come out of the temple, we're going into the temple, I guess, in this case, and we're looking around, and what do you know? The commotion is gone. The commotion in ourselves is gone, right? And there's this great stillness. There's this great stillness. And it's wonderful, right? I mean, people have been coming in and saying, you know, I just feel so... my mind was just a jumble, and now I feel so calm, and I feel so still, and I feel so happy. So that gets us up to the first part of the koan, and I have 3 minutes left. Okay. So when Zhuan Sha came to Pudian district, they welcomed him with 100 festivities. A lot of commotion, right? Next day, he asked great elder Zhao Tong, what happened to all the commotion? It's sort of where we are today, right? And Zhao Tong held up the corner of his vestment. He held up the corner of his robe. And Zhuan Sha said, there's no connection, not by a long shot. No connection. Now, please be vigilant when you're dealing with koans, because koans are like really tricky. They never just say what they mean. There's always like a hidden contradiction or something that doesn't fit your assumptions about reality, right? So Zhuan Sha says there's no connection, not by a long shot. The thing is, you know, there is a connection between the stillness you are achieving here at the Sesshin and the craziness that you've experienced in your life, yeah? That these two things actually go together in a very important way. You know, that the frustrations you felt, the disappointments you've experienced, the unhappiness of your life, whatever, you know, all of that has brought you here, yeah? But also, this is all like this is all helping you to wake up. All of our problems are helping us to wake up. Even the obstacles are helping us to wake up. See, and you know, it's interesting. I have met people who have had experienced tremendous pain and unhappiness in their lives. And they've achieved extraordinary awakening, you know, extraordinary. And those two things in some ways are somewhat inseparable, right? It's like it's the experience of confusion that makes this so precious, right? You know, people who get involved in Zen are often unhappy. And this is like a holy, H-O-L-Y, like a sacred discontent, right? Because the world really is a crazy place. And when you get discontented with it, you might come here. And you begin to enter this beautiful stillness, this beautiful clarity, purifying body, mind, and heart on the cushion. But you can't really wake up without these obstacles. You know, that's absolutely so. And it's true on the basic level. You can't make progress in Zazen without some physical pain. It's just not so otherwise. You know, if you could sit on the cushion and you had no pain, you would be unable to free yourself, to cut through your illusion. And pain, boy, cuts through the illusions. It really does, right? I mean, as I've mentioned in the past, try imagining your way out of pain, right? So really don't do it. But if you wanted to experiment, you know, sit on the cushion, and after the first sit, you're going to have the second sit. The pain begins to increase, and try just dreaming of like a summer vacation, beautiful island, you know. In the presence of pain, those dreams just collapse and blow away, right? Your imagination isn't powerful enough, really, to push that pain away. And that's really like a saving grace for human beings, that imagination is too feeble to deal with that, you know. So the pain just cuts through all of that, and then what you have to do is go back to your breath, back to move. And you push the pain away, and now you begin to get somewhere. Now, so it's like pain is an essential element of practice. But so are all the other obstacles. Pain is like the most elementary obstacle. But so are all the other obstacles we have in our lives. These are all helping us to wake up. So if you're working on a koan and you're thinking, you know, I can't find the answer. You know, I keep doing this, or you feel blocked. You know, I'm just trying to tell you how it really is, that, you know, being blocked is not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. You know, it's like the pressure is building inside you when you're blocked. And you're building the energy to break through the obstacle, right? And in a way, it's really true. You know, the bigger the obstacle, the greater the awakening. This is really so. You know, I hope I'm making some sense, you know. Some of the greatest Zen masters have been people who have had real tragedy, really like terrible tragedies in their lives. And it cast a real shadow over their lives for a long time. And working their way out of that shadow gave them, you know, great awakening, great insight. You know, so please don't feel, if you're having trouble answering your koan, that this is like a disaster, or this is, you know, great misfortune, or that you'll never wake, you know, people go through, oh, I'll never wake up, I'll never achieve it, I knew I was a bum, you know, I knew I'd never be any good, you know. It's not like this. These obstacles are, you know, the koan is designed to produce obstacles, right? Or to ask you to confront your own inner obstacle. And that confrontation is what produces great awakening. So that tension is essential. That tension is essential. You know, it's like a pressure builds up inside yourself. A pressure is building up. And something, you can't work it through with your discriminating intellect. It's got to come from the deeper part of your mind. And, you know, I'll stop in just a moment. But, you know, I myself have never given birth, you know. But I think answering a koan is a little bit like giving birth. Because you go through a long gestation period, right, where it sinks, the koan goes down into your unconscious mind, and it sits there, and it percolates, and it percolates, and it percolates. And it's like pressure builds up, right? Something's going to happen, and you're sitting there thinking, when is this going to happen? You know, when is the baby going to arrive anyway? And then, you know, we go through these things like, oh, it may never come, you know, nothing's going to happen, I'm no good, you know, blah, blah, blah. But eventually, You know, the pressure builds, the pressure builds, the pressure builds, and something is going to come out, right? It's like giving birth. I really believe that, you know. And you can't make it happen. You can't think it into a solution. You know, it's just going to come out of the deepest part of yourself. And it's the obstacles that make this depth possible. Okay? So. When Zhuang Sha came to Pujian district, they welcomed him with 100 festivities. The next day, he asked great elder Zhao Tong, "Where has all of yesterday's commotion gone?" Zhao Tong held up the corner of his vestment. Zhuang Sha said, "There's no connection, not by a long shot." In other words, they're inseparably connected. You know, a man of Zen or a woman of Zen doesn't worry about answering his koan or her koan. The only important thing is to be true to your true nature, is to listen to the voice of your true nature and be the servant of your true nature. And whether you succeed, quote unquote, or fail, quote unquote, shouldn't matter. You know, Zhao Zhu, Lin Ji, these weren't people who sat around going, "Oh my God, I'm getting older and I still haven't answered this call." Right? They listened to the voice of their true nature, and whether you answer your call or die trying, it doesn't matter. You're already doing what your true self has told you to do. Results don't matter. Results don't matter. This is so crucial. So crucial. So, please practice wholeheartedly. Don't think about success or failure. Don't think about results at all. Just be in the moment. Give yourself wholeheartedly to the moment. And if you can do that, you're already in heaven. Even if your legs are killing you, you're slamming up against the wall of move. No, you're in heaven. If you can just not worry about results. Okay? So please, practice with your whole heart.